He's fellowship trained sports medicine and with UT Physicians, and his talk's on assessment of anterior knee pain. Dr. Ozude.
Thank you, guys. Morning. It's a pleasure to be here today and talk to you all about anterior knee pain in athletes. This is a challenging entity and one that deserves a lot of attention because it's so common. And I know you guys probably have a well fund of knowledge about it already, so I hope that this lecture will add to that knowledge and hopefully help going forward in making the accurate diagnosis. So I have no disclosures. So the broad term anterior knee pain has had many different aliases in the past. Patellofemoral disease, patellofemoral pain syndrome, chondromalacia patella. And currently there's an advocation to use anterior knee pain as the actual term because it's more inclusive and more accurately describes the broad range of different actual diagnoses that can be represented in this condition. And as you guys know, as physical therapists and trainers, it's very important to understand fully the condition of anterior knee pain. And that's because it's very common. Its prevalence in sports, it affects 1 in 4 athletes. 70% of those quarter is between 16 and 25 years old. So it's affecting young active adults. And it may account for up to 40% of all knee problems seen in sports medicine clinics. So it's important to practitioners like myself. Its incidence after ACL reconstruction is also very important, particularly with bone patellar tendon bone autografts. It can be seen in up to 40 to 60% of cases at some point in the postoperative period. And while hamstring autograft or allograft are not as well studied, I can definitely tell you that even in that patient group, we also see a lot of stiffness and resulting anterior knee pain following those procedures as well. One thing that is generally accepted in the orthopedic community is that females are more likely to get anterior knee pain compared to males. They are 2.23 times more likely. Also that quad weakness is associated with the development of anterior knee pain. And these other suspected risk factors have been heavily investigated and debated throughout the literature. But when you look at these factors, there's none of them that has actually been proven in literature to actually affect and result in anterior knee pain. But there's still important things to consider as we make the diagnosis and employ treatments for anterior knee pain. So understanding the entity starts at the basic anatomy level. And this is a very complex region, the anterior compartment and the extensor mechanism. It's made up of 3 bones with multiple soft tissue attachments. The largest sesamoid bone, the patella, is a very important functionally as it can experience up to 7 times body weight in certain conditions such as running, and even higher in other conditions such as deep squatting or jumping. The pathogenesis of anterior knee pain has been highly debated as well. There's different schools of thought as to what is the inciting factors, or what are the inciting factors. Malalignment and imbalance is thought by many to be the overarching condition that can lead to overuse and or instability. There's also been research that shows that there is potential ischemic vascular conditions that can cause the resultant pain in the anterior knee structures. And those are more of the overuse, gradual onset type of settings that anterior knee pain can result. And of course, there's other situations where you can get pain in the front of the knee. So acute traumatic injury to the anterior structures. Neural injuries, so referred pain from either the hip or the back, and then skin changes in the overlying tissue of the anterior knee should be considered. So where is this pain exactly coming from? Well, the original or more historical thinking is that chondral injuries are the result of, or chondral injuries are the cause of a lot of this pain. But some histologic studies actually show that the majority of the pain fibers are located in more of the soft tissue, so things like the medial and the lateral retinaculum. In fact, there was a study done by, actually a well-known study done by Dr. Scott Dye, where he performed a knee arthroscopy on his own knee without the pleasure of intra-articular anesthesia. And in that study, he probed his knee at different points and actually recorded a neurosensory map of what structures are actually producing pain. And what he found was structures like articular cartilage and the meniscus and the ligament actually did not yield a high signal of pain, whereas soft tissues like the fat pad or synovium were very exquisitely tender when probed. He also found that subchondral bone, when the intraosseous pressure goes up in subchondral bone, like the patella or the tibia, that also yields very high pain. So where can we find these structures in and around the anterior knee? And it's a broad list of diagnoses that can affect it. The anatomical landmarks and points are also very broad, so there's many considerations here. First, we can start in the native knee, considering the bone. You can have the patella and the proximal tibia with contusions, stress fractures, traction apophysitis in the growth plates in more adolescent or pre-adolescent patients. Then you have cartilaginous structures, such as the patella and the trochlea, the patellofemoral joint. You have the fibrocartilage of the meniscus and the anterior aspect of the knee joint that can also be torn and cause pain. Multiple tendons and their associated bursa cross the knee joint, so therefore they can also be affected with tendinopathies and bursopathies. In addition to the synovium of the bursa, you have the bursa of the intraarticular structures like the plica that can also be affected and cause anterior medial knee pain. In the setting of trauma, you have the MPFL, so different ligaments are also implicated in some of the causes of instability that leads to anterior knee pain. And just some pictures of the synovium. Connective tissue, such as the fat pad just deep to the patellar tendon and just deep to the IT band can also be inflamed. It's very important to consider, as I mentioned before, pain resulting from areas away from the knee. So the hip and the back can also cause referred pain down to the anterior knee. And for completeness, just considering the skin, especially in athletic populations and the team settings, abrasions and infections can present and cause anterior knee pain. In a post-operative knee, it's important to consider causes of anterior knee pain, such as harvest sites of ACL reconstructions, particularly the harvest site of a patellar tendon autograft. Sometimes the fixation devices that we use to fix the graft, particularly on the tibia side, can be prominent and also cause stress areas of the anterior knee. And so how do these patients present? Again, since it's a wide list or broad list of diagnoses, they can present in multiple different ways. One of the very common ways they present is some sort of activity-related pain. Usually, these patients do not have pain at rest. So things like stair climbing or descending, running, jumping, periods of long sitting where the knee is flexed, that's called the movie theater sign. Those are situations where anterior knee pain presents. It's important to consider other things in addition to that. So timing of their pain, onset of their pain, the duration, those are all important in helping figure out the differential diagnosis. Certain symptoms, such as mechanical symptoms, which include locking, clicking, popping, those can help allude to intra-articular causes of pain in the anterior knee. Swelling, either in the soft tissues or within the joint, also can help figure out the diagnosis. Things like weakness and instability, I really like to investigate those things because weakness, if a patient were to come to me and complain of weakness, I often think about, well, did that weakness come first, and did that result in some anterior knee pain due to, you know, overloading of the quadriceps, or did they have pain first and that in anterior knee, and that resulted in an avoidance and subsequent development of weakness in certain muscles. With instability, I like to think about whether their sense of instability is actually coming from structural damage to the knee, versus if they actually just have the sense of weakness from a muscular, or the sense of instability from a muscular weakness once they're loading the joint. And then how often does it affect their performance? Does it affect their practice? Does it keep them out of play? That can all be important to know as far as the severity of the diagnosis. Questions about post-operative rehab and surgical complications are very important to inquire about with these athletes, because sometimes they may not offer that information readily to you. The physical exam, in general, it should be more than just the knee exam. It should encompass multiple different areas of the body. The gait should be assessed. Lower extremity alignment should be assessed. I think this is all the pictures. So yeah, lower extremity alignment, lumbar spine alignment, neuroexam, hip exam, even the foot exam should be considered. Core function is a very important part that we're realizing plays a major role in the function of the knee. The knee should be, or the actual entire exam should be done in multiple positions, standing, sitting, and while laying flat. It's also important to remember to evaluate the contralateral side to establish an internal control in some situations. So first, the standing exam. The alignment should be assessed. You can look for imbalances or obliquity that can signal, you know, scoliosis implications or leg length implications. You can look directly at the lower extremity and look for valgus or varus, coronal plane malalignments, sagittal plane, and axial plane malalignments. The gait should also be assessed to look for dynamic causes of malalignment, either with recurvatum or you may see a Trendelenburg gait as they walk. I like to assess core strength also in this standing position by having patients do things like a dual leg squat or a single leg squat, or having them perform different types of maneuvers where they're balancing on one foot or the other. The sitting exam, you can start to palpate certain anatomical landmarks, looking for specific areas of pain, and that's where understanding the anatomy becomes very important. You can also look at range of motion and look for signs of crepitus or mechanical symptoms that can indicate certain tight structures. You can look at patellar tracking, looking for this J sign, which shows that the patella rides out superiorly and laterally once they go into extension. You can look at for changes in the position of the kneecap, so patella alta and patella baja. You can assess core strength, looking at hip flexion. You can perform different resisted physical exam maneuvers and range of motion to look for pain associated with muscle activation. And the laying exam is probably where you're going to get the most volume of your information. You can also palpate in this position for tender points, but you can get a full, thorough assessment of their range of motion in this position. You can assess for certain limitations in range of motion, such as hamstring flexion contractures by doing the popliteal angle test or the Thomas test, looking for hip flexion contractures. You can assess patellar tilt by trying to invert the patella along the lateral side, looking for tightness. You can also try to mobilize the patella medially and laterally, looking not only for instability, but also for pain. We know that the patella can glide medially and laterally about up to two quadrants. Anything significantly decreased from that may suggest arthrofibrosis or scarring of the anterior interval versus anything that's significantly increased compared to that can suggest instability. Can perform Clark's compression test, looking for patellofemoral joint injuries. And the Plica test is performed by palpating along the medial condyle while taking the patient through range of motion. You may perceive a clunk that's painful once that medial plica snaps over the medial condyle. The prone exam, in the lying exam, you can also use a prone position and lateral position. You can assess for quadriceps tightness using the Duncan Eli test, as well as IT band tightness using the Ober test. As mentioned before, the hip exam is very important when assessing the knee. assessing for different patterns of range of motion are important. And this is significant because the innervation of the hip is actually through the femoral and obturator nerve primarily. And these nerves actually come off the spinal cord at the level of the L2 and 3, 4 roots. And those are the same roots that serve the knee. And this is why hip pathology can present as knee pain, specifically in adolescent and pre-adolescent athletes. For the same reason, the back exam is very important. You're, again, looking for radiculopathic referred pain. So performing tests like the straight leg raise where the hip is flexed and the ankle is dorsiflexed and the cervical spine is flexed, trying to elicit tension signs in the spinal cord. And this is good for uncovering conditions that can affect the nerve roots, such as disc herniations or spondylolisthesis. So after the physical exam, the next step in the assessment is imaging, and this is a side that we probably see a little bit more on the orthopedic side or clinician side, but it's something that I think is good to kind of be exposed to and understand what we think and how we go about making these assessments. So X-ray and MRI, very apparent how important that is in the diagnosis. CT scan is used in a more limited fashion for more specific diagnoses that are related to anterior knee pain. And ultrasound may have some applications, but in my practice to date, I have not used it. In training, I have not seen it used for any diagnostic purposes. So with radiographs, things you can look for, you can identify and confirm patella alta and patella baja by looking at the position of the patella on a lateral x-ray. So you can see here we have patella alta as there is a significant increase in the length of the patellar tendon versus patella baja on this side, on the right side. You can also assess a patellar tilt. There's multiple different ways we use to measure that. I think the best way is the one in the middle, the lateral patellofemoral angle. We use that just by assessing the trochlear horizon versus the horizon made from the lateral facet. Usually that results in an opening or inversion or internal rotation relative to the trochlea. And in that x-ray picture there, you can see how that angle is decreased with tight retinacular structures on the lateral side. So apophysitis also can be seen on the lateral x-ray. You can see traction injuries to the inferior pole of the patella or the tibial tubercle. The biparte patella is something that can be confused with a patella fracture, and therefore it's important to get contralateral films in certain cases, because oftentimes bilateral patellae or biparte patellae can present bilaterally. Sometimes you can see avulsion fractures of the distal pole of the patella as well. Trochlear dysplasia can be assessed. On the left, you can see a normal groove of the trochlea versus a more shallow groove. This can lead to instability, lateral positioning of the patella, and subsequent anterior knee pain. The MRI can show areas of bone inflammation or soft tissue inflammation. Also helping with the diagnosis. So tendinopathy can be seen in the patellar tendon in this sagittal view. You can also see different areas of bursitis. Here we have patellar or infrapatellar bursitis. And there's a picture of suprapatellar bursitis prepatellar bursitis both on the sagittal views as well as the coronal views, the axial views. You can also see bursitis patterns on just lateral and or deep to the IT band in that picture. And then on the left, we see here right around the pes and serine tendons right in this region that there's fluid in that area leading to a potential diagnosis of tendinopathy or pes and serine bursitis. The medial plica can be seen on axial view along with associated changes to the chondral surfaces of the patella. Sitting in between the patellofemoral joint. You can see inflammation of the fat pad, changes in the fat pad in Hoffa syndrome here. Also in postoperative settings, you can also see a collection of that scar tissue around the fat pad in Cyclops lesions after ACL surgery. You can see other views of that condition. And I particularly have noticed that in the superior lateral part of the fat pad, I commonly see this signal, this inflammation. And I think it's due to the tightness of the lateral structures in conjunction with the higher flange of the lateral femoral condyle right in this region. Chondral injuries can be seen on the axial view. Stress injuries to both the patella and the proximal tibia can be seen. Bipartite patella, if the suspicion is high, it's important to know that a lot of them are asymptomatic and may just be finding that you come across on x-ray. But if your suspicion is high, there are situations where you can fracture across the fibrous junction of the fragment. So sometimes an MRI can help delineate that. As mentioned before, anterior tears of the meniscus can present with pain, especially when they're associated with large flap tears or parameniscal cysts that are in the front of the soft tissues. And in the trauma setting, MPFL injury can be seen with associated injuries either off the femur side or off the patella side. CT has limited application, but it can be very useful for further delineating the trochlear dysplasia, the loss of the groove of the femur at the patellofemoral joint. And then specifically, there's certain software that can be used to actually superimpose the knee joint, the patellofemoral joint, with the tibial tubercle. And in doing so, we can evaluate the relationship of the kneecap as it sits in the groove with its attachment distally on the tibial tubercle. This is the TT-TG ratio, the tibial tubercle to the tibial groove. And it said if that tibial tubercle sits laterally over 20 millimeters compared to the tibial, to the trochlear groove, it's an indication of malalignment. And this can help guide us when making decisions about whether surgical intervention is necessary or not with procedures like a Fulkerson osteotomy. So hip imaging, also very important. On the left, we see a more normal hip with normal coverage of the ball and socket joint. On the right, we can see a case of a dysplastic hip. This can lead to pain generated from the hip but referred to the knee. There are conditions in younger patients, leg Calf-Perthes disease, where you get an osteochondrosis and necrosis of the femoral head. And subsequent complication of that on the right, you see with the left hip there's a enlargening of the femoral head. This can all cause symptoms in the hip referred to the knee. Skiffy is a condition that you see in adolescent population, can be seen on x-ray. It's good when considering at-risk populations such as pre-adolescent or adolescent, obese, African-American males. And on the right there's an example of a femoral stress injury, a femoral neck stress injury, which also can be seen on MRI. And again, this is helpful for looking at-risk populations, so female runners who may present with a female triad. Back imaging is important. As mentioned before, looking at conditions such as spondylolisthesis, our at-risk population in that group is linemen, offensive linemen in football, as well as gymnasts. And then for disc herniations, that can perhaps affect almost any athlete, so that's something to be considered. And then treatment, I'll just briefly touch on this because I think it's just as challenging to think about the treatment options as it is to just make the diagnosis. Really, the first step of treatment is prevention. And as you guys probably know, there's several other conservative forms of treatment for anterior knee pain. And obviously, surgery is a last option, but an option in some patients and can have good benefits. And that's really it. My take homes are the importance is really making the diagnosis. And in order to do that, a good understanding of the anatomy is crucial. Being thorough with the history and the physical exam are very critical. And always consider other structures such as the hip and the back when considering these athletes. And I think, with that in mind, with this approach, you can kind of feel a little bit less anxious when, you're presented with patients and athletes with anterior knee pain.